Holiness, I'm Anne Harrington. We met at a meeting at MIT some years ago. I worked on the conference that you participated in. I'm delighted to welcome you.
Chicago.
Yes,
Oh, I went to the.
you remember.
Oh.
Yes, at heart.
Same person.
Same person,
Same
sorry.
person. Hello, hello, hello. Da, hello. Hello. Ha. Yeah. Desele, desele, desele. Desele, desele. Desele, 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 desele. Hello, 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 hello. Hola. Desele, desele. Oh, yeah. Hola, desele.
Your Holiness, I'd like just to introduce you briefly to the people who, with whom you will be speaking this morning. Don't trip over the monitor. This is Liz Nielsen. She is a scientist and psychologist who works on aging and health. This is David Spiegel, who you have met before. He is a psychiatrist who is interested in cancer and alleviating the distress of patients with cancer. This is Jimmy Holland. She is a psychiatrist also. She also works in the area of cancer and pain relief. And we know each other. So please, would you care for a cup of tea?
Oh, no.
No? Your Holiness, in this conference today, in the dialogues we're going to be having today, we're having them at a center that is famous for world-class medical research. And in that context, we are interested in taking a new look at a well-known and very important problem in modern medicine. Namely, the way in which research based in the laboratory has tended over years, over the generations, to focus more and more attention on the disease that the patient is suffering from, and less attention on the patient with the disease, on the person, the suffering person. Modern medicine is often criticized for focusing all its attention on what's wrong with patient with the body and overlooking the mental suffering of the patient who is experiencing a serious disease, his anxiety, his fear of death, his sadness, his distress. Modern medicine is often criticized for not paying enough attention to ways in which a patient's disease affects the rest of a patient's life. What effect is it having on the family, on his capacity to work, on his relationship with his community, on the sense of his meaning of life, and how he can, whether or not he can still help or serve others. For patients, all of these things are connected. The disease, their suffering, how it, their larger life, all of these things are connected, but for modern medicine, they often don't seem to feel connected. But we believe that new research in the behavioral sciences, in medicine, may start to be in a position to put things back together again, to reconnect disease, suffering, and life story into a single integrated whole. We believe that new research may be able to help modern medicine better appreciate something that patients have always known, that their disease, their suffering, their life story are all connected. And we believe that we may be able to do this by showing that mental suffering, life story affect the brain, affect the body, are not disconnected from the course of a disease. And we will be presenting research today that talks about this and inviting a dialogue with you about what you see, the benefits, the potential benefits and challenges here. We're looking forward to exploring all of these ideas with you over the course of an exciting day. And we will begin this morning now by turning to my friend Jimmy Holland, who will talk to you about distress.
Okay. Good morning. Great pleasure to be part of this and to be part of the dialogue and with this wonderful audience who clearly come interested in these issues. My role with you and with the group this morning is to talk about this gap between the laboratory and the clinic. It's a broad one, and I'm going to bring an example from cancer care to talk about. If you look at literature, there are many studies that show that patients do not receive the care that research shows they would benefit from. One study found 55% of patients were receiving less than what guidelines would recommend. So we know that the goal is to bring basic science to clinical application, to everyday care. And it's that clinical side that I represent because I've been at the Cancer Hospital Memorial Sloan Kettering for over 30 years. So I have lots of experience in the real world of that. Oops, I'm caught back here on my somewhere or other. Sorry. I think it caught on my...
your hair?
No, it's caught on my something.
Caught on something.
Oh, well, hang on.
Something is not right.
All right.
We don't want to hang anybody.
I think you're all right. I think.
Thank you. Now I'd move my head.
We don't want any medical emergencies
around,
here.
So I don't have to move my head quite so far. So I represent the clinical side, the bedside, the real world, and we're going to hear wonderful science today from things that we hope to be coming to the bedside. Now, so we would like that distance to be very short between the basic science and the bedside. And if we could take the mouse and just move him and all the equipment and the interpretations over to the human side, it would make it so easy. But that isn't real life. And I'll show you what's real life. Because actually science must move from the basic research, which we sometimes call the bench, through a process of dissemination and then implementation. So we have to get the word out, get it to people, get it to the clinicians, and then finally get it applied as a routine at the bedside. And so that is where we will be concentrating as I talk on this middle area here, dissemination. And actually, evidence-based medicine was really established to assure that research findings were getting to patient care, and they've been around for quite a long while. However, findings get stuck. They don't get moved into the arena of care. And so there's now research going into what is behind this. How do we change attitudes? It's a very important new area of research. So I'm going to tell you about a real-world challenge that I've been dealing with, which is bringing science of psychosocial care and issues to routine practice in cancer care. If you think about it for a moment, we've had some difficult barriers. Cancer was considered so frightening that people were not given their diagnosis. So the first barrier was that we could not talk to people unless they knew what their illness was. I was once invited to a hospital to work, and they said, 1974, you can do anything you want with my patients, just don't tell them they have cancer. So it's pretty amazing that how things were then. So we, So around 1975, patients began to be told their diagnosis, and we began our work in cancer to try to bring psychological, social issues more to the forefront. So we formed this little subspecialty we call psycho-oncology. But it's multidisciplinary, involves psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, nurses, clergy, all of us together studying what cancer does to people. What are their reactions to it? And then the other side of it is, well, what do people do to change their risk to prevent it or even survival? So this is a little area that's evolved over the last 30 years. Second big challenge we had was the fact that patient ability to talk about their symptoms, their anxiety, their pain. That this was not accepted as a valid measure of anything, only what the doctor thought. The doctor thought the patient had very little pain, and the patient said it's a lot. They went on the doctor's decision. So there were no rating scales, and so what we had to do was develop some reliable scales with numbers, quantitative scales, so that we could show that if we intervene with a particular thing, anxiety, and we reduced it, we could show that with data, with numbers. So today we can measure these various subjective symptoms, and we have been able to use those scales now to show that interventions like contemplative science interventions really work. But we were hit in the 1990s with managed care. So clinics, hospitals, offices for cancer care have been very busy. People are seen for short periods. And so I think psychosocial problems got short shrift, to put it mildly. And yet the data shows that about a third of people have significant distress at some point in the course of their illness. So I would call this a breakthrough that in 97 we had a panel that sat down together representing everyone who has an interest in cancer patient care, and we were mandated to find out what is the problem. And so the panel decided that the first problem is nobody likes the word psychological or psychiatric. They're stigmatized words. Oncologists didn't want to ask the patient, you know, how's you're doing emotionally. The patient often would be reluctant to tell the doctor how they felt because, you know, he might think I'm a wimp and wouldn't treat me. So we had this issue, and the panel came up with the idea that if we use the word distress, it's a kind of encompassing word, and that would not be stigmatizing. Because if you think about it, it'd be normal if you have cancer, it's normal to be to have a level of distress with fears and worries, but that could become severe, severe enough that it would require treatment, or it might impede their ability to take their cancer treatment. So if you think about it for a moment, all the things that cause a person to be distressed are really all the way from dealing with physical pain, with fears, with complications, worrying about their family, worrying about how do I find some meaning in my life, how do I find some kind of structure from which I can face this and to face my possible death, how can I find meaning in the life that's now limited. I use this little cartoon because the patient's sitting there with the psychiatrist saying, don't you have anything better to offer me than reality? And so I say to patients, you know, I can't change your reality. We can't change the cancer. But we can make it easier for you to live with it. Mm-hmm. So the next task was, how do we rapidly get the oncologist to identify who is distressed? We noted over the 90s that pain management became much more effective when they began to ask the patient the simple question, how's your pain 0 to 10? If the patient said it's more than 5, then that meant it was an algorithm immediately to look at their pain. we chose that same thing, and we used on your left side here the distress thermometer, a little 0 to 10 scale, which says, how is your distress this past week? Mark on this in the waiting room while you're sitting, waiting for the doctor. Mark on this little thermometer. And if they mark 4 or above, we've learned by studying it.
Question.
Yes, yes, sir. Self-report in the waiting room with a piece of paper. And if they mark 4 or more, then it goes to the next step, which is a guideline that must go to clinical evaluation, be evaluated a little further by the team, and then referred to mental health, social, or pastoral services.
So you just draw on a line.
You draw on a line. And the prior slide showed you could mark off, were your problems spiritual, psychological, family, practical. So what has come out of this is that we have now are asking people that the 6 vital signs should be after pain. We've always had 4 vital signs, pulse, respiration, temperature, blood pressure. Now pain has been added, and we think distress should be the 6th vital sign. So 2 things have happened that have pushed the story along in a positive way that I want to tell you. First was 2005, we have $1 million given to the Institute of Medicine to study why are cancer patients complaining about this and find an action plan for them. So what happened with a year of deliberation by a good committee, multidisciplinary, was that we found evidence base strong for communication, doctor-patient communication is critical. Psychotherapies of various kinds are effective. Several drugs are working work very well. Self-management, teaching people about their disease. And behavioral interventions, many of which would be similar to meditation. But we also begin to see how hard it is for the caregiver, how stressed the family memory is as well. Then came along 2008, another major move forward for us, and this was that came out of that a long study, was that the psychosocial domain must be integrated into routine care. And that's the report right there. Care for the whole patient, that's the idea. This is the model which we put together, and you can see it. The treatment plan must include consideration of these problems. But then how do we implement this? We got the idea, we have the guideline, how do we implement it? That's been our next issue. And in this past year, the body that accredits cancer centers, 1,500 around the country, have mandated that to be accredited by 2015, they must have integrated this domain into routine care. About 2 minutes. 1 minute. Okay. So I'm sorry. So we took this to the international community, of which we have organizations in every major country and working in developing countries. And we took this same idea. We said we must integrate it in psychosocial and routine care and make it the 6th vital sign. And I'm going to show you 47 different international cancer organizations that have endorsed this. You don't need to know each one, but it's really quite remarkable the degree to which that has occurred. And we now have a meeting conjoint with oncologists and all of our international group in Australia coming up next month. So I think you have an idea that here's a little bit of a success story, small but a good story. And what has happened is that right now, 2012, I think we do have a kind of science of psychosocial care. We have evidence-based interventions, we have guidelines, which creates a science, but the real issue then is making sure that this international standard of recognizing the distressed person, triaging them to care, is the way that we must really move at this point. So I thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your Holiness, did you have any questions you wanted to ask Jimmy Holland about what she has just said?
Now it is quite, clear, quite evident, the physical health and mental state.
Very closely connected.
Connected. Now I just felt. Now we have to work out the mental state or mental sort of feeling, mental experience, affect physical. How? There must be some bridge.
Mechanism. No.
I think our practice, now for example, the single-pointed meditation, that's common, Buddhist and also non-Buddhist Indian tradition. So, tangyati sim tsishil tu snen di dhizane, kanzonso ne luji nengele chisil chisil chi. Tendriki kienbe ini, ngayla lu shinjang da sim shinjang sayi sudwa. Tā kāntā tī tā tūgus dhāla yung kōrba. Tā tī, āni ngā shūng nē, jūngā thārā shēdhā tī. Tā tī dhāla jī yāsarī.
So, His Holiness was saying that, you know, it occurred to him, given the clear evidence we now see in the connection between the state of mind and the actual physical health, it reminds him of the statements that are found in the contemplative traditions, both Buddhist and non-Buddhist Indian traditions, where, for example, as a result of a meditation where you place your mind without, you know, with single-pointed focus and be completely absorbed on a chosen object, and as a result of that kind of training, there is an understanding that kind of a lethargic aspects of our, even the physical body, can be overcome, and then there's, you know, the individual acquires a kind of a suppleness of both body and mind. Mm-hmm. So already in these texts, there is an understanding of a mechanism in the relationship between the state of mind and the physical body as well.
So do you usually say, of course, this body itself, the composition of five elements. Now there, of course, the physical pain, just you see, think, or no longer pain, won't help.
Right. Well, David might have something to say about that.
he might change
your mind.
That is to me, your mind is some change in it. Lokshi. Ta wana ni samlu hulu yana, chigi, luvu kashuru pake, ta luvu trading sore, kada luvu dewa yungu yata, kandisim gore. That the Tanacha was.
So, of course, there is definitely a physiological level where there are experiences such as pain. Now, and then for a person to say there is no physical pain would be actually a false statement. But at the same time, we do know that as a result of, say, for example, maintaining a calm state of mind, it has an effect on the overall health of the individual. But
and
then
also,
the question is...
Also, you see, the mental state, some kind of optimism, oh, I will recover. Mm-hmm. That kind of more
optimism.
It helps.
It does, you're right.
Oh. Mm-hmm. So now how?
His Holiness is saying that we need to find out what is the mechanism in which this causation is working.
Mm-hmm. I think here is some explanation in usual sort of yoga practice. The five elements, there's grosser level of five elements. Now there's the solid and liquid
material level, yeah.
And heat, these things. Then more sort of subtle level, another five elements. I think there may be is a different level of five elements. So here then, there also is, we usually I describe energy. Energy. Mind and energy always go together. The energy, of course, literally we say lum.
The literal term that we use is really wind or air. So, but that doesn't really say much about what the phenomenon is.
Mm-hmm.
So the word energy seems to capture the function better.
So without that energy, mind cannot movement. That energy, formless, as like mind, formless, but different function. Mind, awareness. That energy, movement.
Movement.
So there are also different levels. So, I don't know.
I think you do.
I think that was good. Yes.
Your Holiness, there was another question Jimmy wanted to ask you, but I think in the interest of time, I will hold that back and ask it when we have the open conversation, and instead I will invite David Spiegel to continue to open up some of these issues about how to integrate the mind into healthcare. David.